This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Tonight, we bring you two truth-tellers who aren't stopping. We all know Trevor Noah from his stand-up and his work on The Daily Show. But in the last weeks, as other commentators have struggled to find footing, his commentary has reached a new level of fearlessness and refusal of hypocrisy. In his new book, Born a Crime, he tells the story of his childhood growing up biracial in apartheid and then post-apartheid South Africa. A couple of weeks ago, I was reading my advanced copy, and I tried to explain to my 11-year-old how a system could be created to literally separate different races from each other. "It could never happen here," I told him. "Our government is set up to protect all people, regardless of race." What Trevor wrote as a memoir has become a human, imperfect roadmap to our moment. He teaches us to laugh in the face of hatred. "None of this is a joke," he tells us, "but we have to keep laughing at it all to stay human." I have a mission for you. I want you to read your copy of this amazing book, Born a Crime, and then I want you to bring it home with you for Thanksgiving. That's right. Pick someone in your family that needs to be woken up. Then hand your copy to your brother or your uncle. It's always the uncle, right? Why is that? Don't talk about it too much. Don't preach. You know, just say what a funny dude Trevor is and give it to them. Trevor's writing will do the work for you. Tonight, he is in conversation with a man who shares many things with him, not the least of all, a fiercely supportive mother who pushes him to work harder. These two were not allowed to stop. Cory Booker has devoted his entire life to genuinely addressing economic inequality, not just to talking about it. In his time as a public counselor, then mayor of Newark, then in the Senate, and as author of the best-selling United, Booker has worked tirelessly on issues of social justice, education, and prison reform. In the past 2 weeks, Senator Booker has not shied away from difficult conversations and has bravely taken a stand against the rise of hatred in our country. Yeah. A couple of days after the election, Senator Booker tweeted a quote, "The devil whispered in my ear, 'You are not strong enough for the storm.' Today I whispered in the devil's ear, 'I am the storm.'" Please help me welcome the storm. Stand up for Senator Booker and Trevor Noah.
All right. So, Trevor and I aren't talking tonight. We're actually going to be singing duets. No, I'm so pleased to see everybody here tonight. And I made a confession when I walked in to see Trevor that I would not have read his book with all that's going on. But it ended up being something that I didn't love, was not the right word. I cherish this. I cherish it. It was a gift to me during some really tough days over this last week and helped to deepen me to this understanding of the idea of struggle. And I think it's something that's remarkable. And I really hope that you'll read this book. I hope you'll buy extra copies, because I do think this is something you can give away. My family is literally sitting here. I'm buying at the end of the night copies for them, because it's really an unexpected gift. The second thing I want to say before I ask you my first question is that it was very unexpected. I have a friend that knows you really well, and we were both texting back and forth. Like, we had no idea. We see you on The Daily Show. We just figure, here's a black guy from South Africa, got on The Daily Show, and wow. But this book is an odyssey that I never could have imagined, and you wrote with such unflinching courage and honesty, coupled with your wit. But it is a kind of humor that, strangely, I felt like I grew up with, in the sense of listening to Richard Pryor or the comedians that healed my father, it seemed. A humor that recognized the wretchedness of the world, but helped us cope better. Why did you write it in the first place? Why was it important to you to write this book?
Well, first of all, thank you for reading it, and thank you, everybody, for being here with me. The biggest reason I wrote the book was just because of it was friends, it was family, it was everyone I told stories to who said to me, have you ever said that on stage? I would tell a story, and someone would say, have you ever told that story? And I'd say, no. You know, and I never believed that sharing my stories, which seemed so unique, would ever connect with anybody. I never realized how in specificity you could achieve themes that were as broad as they are in the book. I would have never thought that my suffering in a township in South Africa could connect with your suffering all the way across the world on another continent. You know, I never thought that stories of domestic abuse that I went through and my mother endured were things that would connect with people in places all over the world. But when I wrote it, I wrote it to share. I wrote it for two reasons. One, for myself as a cathartic experience. You know, I do realize that I did not live the easiest life. And the second reason was I wrote it to share and connect with people. Genuinely, a lot of people, and I understand, had no clue where I had come from. People just saw this random human being who popped up on The Daily Show, and, you know, and Jon Stewart's sanity was questioned, and... And really, I could understand, because for people, they're like, who the hell are you? You're wearing a suit. You look like you've lived a wonderful life. Why the hell should we listen to anything you say? Or who are you to even talk to us or with us? And I realized that, as you do in any friendship, what you do to connect with a person is you tell them your stories. And, you know, my stand-up comedy audiences know me through my stories, and I thought, well, there are people who are willing to read the book, then hopefully they can get to know me and we can get to know each other better through the stories I tell here.
But as I'm reading it, lots of people tell their stories, but you have this unflinching honesty in it. And literally there were moments where my lawyer hat came on. I'm like, okay, thank God. I think the statute of limitations has expired on this. I don't think that we're going to have to extradite him. Well, maybe if they ask for extradition, I'll fight it. I'll use my Senate seat. We will not give up Trevor.
Thank you so much. Thank you. No, you know what? It is a tall order. When you start writing a book, when you start telling your stories, you come to realize the Herculean task that's ahead of you, and that is unflinching honesty. And I sat down with my editor, and the question was, how honest do I want to be? And I realized if I write the book and I'm not completely honest, then there will always be these hidden minds that I'm hoping not to provoke as I talk about the book or as I share the stories with people. Someone may not understand a story because I did not tell the truth about how it came to be or how I ended up in that position, because I'm trying to gloss over my life, I'm trying to make myself look better than I am, or trying to make my world seem, you know, slightly more polished than it is. And it's just easier. I realize, I said, it's easier. You know, judge me if you want to judge me, but I think if we're honest about our stories with each other, and, you know, and that was really something that I got from my mom. One of the greatest gifts was her saying to me, we share these things and we share them honestly. And she was referring to domestic abuse. And she said, because so many people in a community, so many women are hiding the story, sitting next to somebody who has the exact same thing happening to them. And everyone is glossing over it. Everyone is masquerading because they don't want to be the one who's seen as weak, not realizing that everybody that you are talking to maybe going through the same thing.
So I want to start there and maybe even end there in my questions before we get to a lot of the folks here who've been so kind to write things down. And I want to encourage everybody, we won't stick to just these. I want them to continue to run questions up. If you all have things, please write them down. And in the name of unflinching honesty, ask your honest questions. He can ignore them if he wants, but ask them anyway. I do think it's the Born a Crime subtitle of the book is like, where did that come from? And I want to get to that. And so could you actually pick up the book, and would you be willing to read, starting on page 27, where it says, where most children are proof? And while he's looking for that, I want you to know, I've got the book here, and I've also listened to the book as well, because I think having both for me was a gift. Because you first of all, I couldn't pronounce the clausa. The
oh, that's good.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's actually pretty good.
I've listened to you do it now for like 10 hours.
That's really impressive. That's really impressive.
But your accents, the way you take on other characters in the book.
Thank you very much.
Especially the thing that would make me smile the most is when you are the little you. But why don't you read this for me?
All right. Where most children are proof of their parents' love, I was the proof of their criminality. The only time I could be with my father was indoors. If we left the house, he'd have to walk across the street from us. My mom and I used to go to Jubea Park all the time. It's the central park of Johannesburg. Beautiful gardens, a zoo, a giant chessboard with human-sized pieces that people would play. My mother tells me that once, when I was a toddler, my dad tried to go with us. We were in the park. He was walking a good bit away from us. And I ran after him, screaming, "Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!" People started looking. He panicked and ran away. I thought it was a game and kept chasing him. I couldn't walk with my mother either. A light-skinned child with a black woman would raise too many questions. When I was a newborn, she could wrap me up and take me anywhere. But very quickly, that was no longer an option. You see, I was a giant baby. Mm-hmm. An enormous child. When I was one, you would have thought I was two. When I was two, you'd have thought I was four. There was no way to hide me. My mom, same as she'd done with her flat and with her maid's uniforms, found the cracks in the system. It was illegal to be mixed. In other words, to have a black parent and a white parent. But it was not illegal to be colored. In other words, to have two parents who were both colored. So my mom moved me around the world as a colored child. She found a creche in a colored area where she could leave me while she was at work. There was a colored woman named Queen who lived in our block of flats. When we wanted to go out to the park, my mom would invite her to go with us. Queen would walk next to me and act like she was my mother. And my mother would walk a few steps behind like she was the maid working for the colored woman. I've got dozens of pictures of me walking with this woman who looks exactly like me, but who isn't my mother. And the black woman standing behind us, who looks like she's photobombing the picture, that's my mom. When we didn't have a colored woman to walk with us, my mom would risk walking me on her own. She would hold my hand or carry me, but if the police showed up, she would have to drop me and pretend I wasn't hers. I felt like I was a bag of weed.
So there's a whole bunch of powerful dynamics that are in there, and one, I just want to make it clear. In South Africa, there are black communities.
Yes.
There are colored communities, which are people that look like you and I, that look like they're mixed
yes.
descent. And then there are white communities. And then there are a whole lot of other confusing folks who they had to try to figure out a way to warp their laws. So I chuckled at a funny part where you were like, they're Chinese were considered black.
And Japanese people were considered white.
Right, and you were saying that a police officer could see some guy on a park bench and come over to them and be like, you're black, you can't sit there. And he goes, no, I'm Japanese. And
Look, the truth is, apartheid was a ridiculous system. Racism is a ridiculous thing when you think about it because it is artificial, it's a construct. But it's simple. And a lot of the time, a lot of stupid ideas are exactly that. They are simple, and that is why they work so well in terms of convincing people to continue subscribing to them. But in South Africa, because you had a situation where 6% of the population was in power, and they were trying to control the remaining 94%, how do you go about doing that? That's a Herculean task. So the South African government sets out to create the most perfect form of racism, the most perfect form of oppression and segregation. And they went out to all the countries where they thought they could find the right information. They went to Australia, they went to the Netherlands, they came to the United States, and they searched for all types of racisms, and they wanted to seek out what was the best way to oppress a group of people. And they found cracks in all the different systems, and they worked to patch that software, essentially. And one of the things they found, and that was almost a weakness in America, was in America you had the one-drop rule. So if you were a person who had a drop of black blood in you, you were black. In South Africa, they couldn't allow the same metric because that meant you would now be a black person who is added to the majority, and the majority increasing was not something they wanted. So instead, what they set out to do was, they said if you were a person who was black, and then you were also half white, they would then recategorize you as a new race, and that race they called colored. And so colored people who were born of mixed parents were taken away from their families, and over time, as insane as it sounds, an entire race grew from this, an entire community grew from this, generations of people who essentially look mixed race, but have no parents of either race. So their parents are mixed, as in colored, but then it's colored, 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 generation to generation, and they don't even live as black or white, have their own dialect, their own culture. And that was the power of apartheid.
But that's what made you such, and forgive me for using this word, but an oddity, if I can use that word. And it's because, first of all, your mom, who I don't want to lose how courageous she is, and the next thing I want you to read sort of reflects maybe a little of this, but your mom made this conscious decision with this European man who didn't want to have kids, but convinced him to have you, and now you are... Many children like this that are born from such people that have a child are taken away to orphanages.
Yes.
But your mom decides to keep you, so she's not safe with you in black communities where you stick out and people could snitch on you. They're not safe with you in white communities where you stick out and there could be problems. Like, she risks, especially in your early childhood, when you had a tendency to run a lot.
Yes, I
say that to him because...
I enjoyed running.
Yes. I wanted my mom to read this book also because I was a bad child, but when I read this book, I thought my mom would look and say, well, thank God you weren't that bad.
throwing me under the bus.
Yes, I am. I'm still working after 40 years to get back in my mom's good graces. So you created a layers and layers of complexity, not just for your mother who was trying to raise you, but you also created or came up in an environment where none of those communities accepted you as theirs.
I mean, that was the biggest thing that I had to deal with. And, you know, I was lucky in that my mom was always an outsider in her own right. So I looked to her as my mentor, in essence, in terms of learning how to live in a space that treats you as an outsider, treats you as someone who does not belong. But you can imagine, I grew up in a world where everywhere I went, I was an outsider. We lived in Soweto, which was a black community. And I mean black across the board. There were no light-skinned people. There were no white people. Soweto was completely black. I was the only person who looked like this in my entire neighborhood, you know, for miles and miles. People knew of me because of my skin color. It was almost like a myth for some people, you know. And when we went to a white neighborhood, then I would stick out. And when I was in a colored neighborhood, ironically, that was one of the places where I would feel the most backlash, was because I looked exactly like the people, but I wasn't of them, because I wasn't like them culturally. I didn't have the same accent. I didn't speak the same language. And that's when I came to learn that sometimes in life, it's easier to be an insider as an outsider than it is to be an outsider as an insider. You know, and that is when you are in a community where you do not subscribe to the norms of that community, sometimes your own people will be the quickest to lash out at you and lambast you for shunning what they believe. You know, they believe that you are shunning everything that you appear to be. And so that was something that I learned very early on. And that was pretty much what predicated the rest of my life.
And you write about that in beautiful prose. I can't wait till everybody here gets to read to you in wonderful detail about talking about that. And I did find parallels within the American society. But I want to get to this. Your mother is your partner. She's your role model. But you guys have this dynamic that is so fascinating to me. And how you guys coped with this warped, disturbed world was fascinating. And I want to talk about two of those types of coping mechanisms. So your mom is this strong woman. You and I both were talking about how we said black women mothers, I'm sure some other ethnicities can relate to this, they're going to beat you or put you into your place so you understand, so you don't do things that endanger your own life.
Yeah, my mom always said, she said, I will kill you before the world kills you. My mom always said that. She said, I'm not going to let you go out there and let the police kill you. I'm not going to go out there and let the world. She said, the world is coming for you. So she said, I will be the one who takes you out of, she says, I brought you into this world and I will take you out of it. But I will not stand by and say I didn't do everything I could to make sure that you understood the difference between right and wrong.
But open to page 9, because one of the other coping mechanisms, which is deep within the African-American tradition, is that your mom had a profound allegiance to a white man named Jesus. And her deep, at the bottom of the page...
Well, he wasn't really white, but anyway.
I said, hey. As we speak about this in a synagogue, okay. start with at the very bottom of the page, my mother, and end with the word spanking, please.
Where are we, page?
Page 9 at the very bottom. My mother is as stubborn.
Okay. My mother is as stubborn as she is religious. Once her mind's made up, that's it. Indeed, obstacles that would normally lead a person to change their plans, like a car breaking down, only made her more determined to forge ahead. It's the devil, she said about the stalled car. The devil doesn't want us to go to church. That's why we've got to catch minibuses. Whenever I found myself up against my mother's faith obstinacy, I would try as respectfully as possible to counter with an opposing point of view. Or, I said, the Lord knows that today we shouldn't go to church, which is why he made sure the car wouldn't start, so that we stay at home as a family and take a day of rest, because even the Lord rested. Ah, that's the devil talking, Trevor. No, because Jesus is in control. And if Jesus is in control and we pray to Jesus, he would let the car start. But he hasn't, therefore... No, Trevor, sometimes Jesus puts obstacles in your way to see if you overcome them. Like Job, this could be a test. Ah, yes, Mom, but the test could be to see if we're willing to accept what has happened and stay at home and praise Jesus for his wisdom. No. That's the devil talking. Now go change your clothes. But Mom, Trevor, sunkhela is a phrase with many shades of meaning. It says, don't undermine me, don't underestimate me, and just try me. It's a command and a threat all at once. It's a common thing for Xhosa parents to say to their kids. Anytime I heard it, I knew it meant the conversation was over. And if I muttered another word, I was in for a hiding, basically what we call a spanking.
So, by the way, my mom didn't have that class of words. She just had to look. So this banter between you and your mom goes on littered throughout the book.
Yes.
Even to the point where you're adults, and after an ending which stunned me that I'm not going to tell people about, even then you almost had a debate about what God's intention was. But your mom used religion as a coping mechanism, and it helped to ground her. Is that right?
Definitely. I think my mom used religion in the way I feel we should all use religion. And that is, she used it as a guide. She used it as a roadmap. She used it as a place of solace. You know, oftentimes I get brokenhearted when people use religion as a tool to oppress other people, as opposed to using religion as a space where you can exist and find your answers. My mom is a deeply religious woman who, at a time that was trying in her life, found religion and continued, to find religion. She became a scholar of the Bible, and later on in my life, you know, she got really wrapped up and converted to Judaism. And we lived in this world where religion was all I knew. My mom was always searching for answers. She was always searching for scriptures that would give her enlightenment. And I mean, as a kid, I didn't appreciate it because all that meant was more church, you know. I went to church 3 or 4 times every single Sunday. In a week, we were going to church in some way, shape, or form. Maybe.
And they were very different
times.
Churches, right?
Yeah, every church was different. We started off, we would go to, there was like a multiracial church that we went to, which was like a pop Christian rock church, you know, the ones with the karaoke screens and the rock band playing. And we would go to like a very, you know, orthodox, like a white church with very calm and, you know, singing the, you know, all things bright and beautiful, like those types of churches. And then we would always end the day at black church. And that was like in the township, and it would be like tent style evangelical. And it just, like, it never ended. It never, black church takes so, like, if you've ever been to black church, you're probably still there now. Like, you know what I'm talking about. Black turd, it takes forever. And as a kid, I always used to think to myself, I used to sit there and I would go, the only thing I could think of was, black people just need more time with Jesus because things are really not going well. You know, white people just come to check in and leave, and then black people would, they would be like, no, no, we need another thing and another thing and another thing. But that's where we found more than just answers. We also found community.
Yes.
And that was the wonderful thing about a church, was that, you know, a church was a space where a new tribe was created that existed beyond race, a new tribe that existed beyond class. It was a space where everyone was searching out for the same thing, and everyone was governed by the same laws and in agreement. And that's basically how we lived our lives. And, you know, my mom at a certain age wasn't as pressing on me in terms of, you know, being as religious as she wanted me to be. And that's where, like, when I tell people the stories of Judaism, like, that came out of nowhere in my world, because one day my mom just decided, she said, I can't, she had read the Bible, I think 20, 30, maybe even 40 times, and she said, I need more. And that, you know, she found out that the scriptures had been converted, and she said, I want to learn, and she started learning Hebrew, and she said, I want to read more scriptures. And then I come home in my world, and then my mom is saying, like, things to me like, Baruch Hashem Adonai. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, I don't know what's going on right now. And then she's telling me that I've got a bar mitzvah, and I don't know what this is. And so...
Was there a circumcision at all in there? No?
I was circumcised my mom was in religion, so I was circumcised as a child. Like, we lived like that. And when I turned 13, my mom was like, okay, you're a man, we're going to give you a bar mitzvah. And you got to understand, I only have black family members. You know, my dad's Swiss and his family's in Switzerland. So she said this. And then she said, you've got a bar mitzvah. And nobody came. Because nobody knew what this thing was. And my mom just said to me, you're now a man. And then she gave me a little bit of money. And she was like, okay. And I was like, I don't know what just happened in this world. All I know is now I'm saying Shana Tova. And now... But that's really... Religion was a family that we could claim that we never had. And that's really a really great role that it played in our lives.
But... So this is your mom's coping mechanism, and obviously it had a deep effect on you as well, Yasher Koach. But I watched through your prose, sort of two other coping mechanisms that you had to develop, because this is not just the toughness of the race lines that you were dealing with. You were dealing with the toughness of, and not also the domestic violence, but you were also dealing with the toughness of poverty. I mean, just the things you were forced to eat
caterpillar.
Yes, thank you.
Why
very much.
Why is it sticking on your tongue? You can't even say it? Is that how bad it is?
I'm telling you.
That's how it feels on your tongue, by the way, when you're trying to eat it. That's exactly what happens.
Yeah, I almost want to tell you, I almost want to mark those pages for you so you know to read them really quickly. Or, again, I'm a vegan, so this is really difficult. But the smileys, I guess the
goat's head,
the goat's head, yeah, and the descriptions of the eyeballs that you had.
Yes,
to eat.
Yes. But you know, that was one of those things where when people who read the book, the one thing I always feel when they meet me after the book, they go, I didn't know you had such a tough life, and I'm so sorry. And I honestly tell people, I say, I acknowledge that there were moments of toughness, and I realize that we went through a really rough period. But I always hope people don't think, I do not tell those stories in any way trying to elicit sympathy, because if anything, I was just trying to paint a picture of the world that I, and more importantly, we lived in. This was the black experience in South Africa. This wasn't my experience. This wasn't something that I was doing on my own. Many families were eating caterpillars around me.
But this is the point I'm trying to make. So, I love the way you talk about things in a way that the same scene that you paint an American would find objectionable. Like, I didn't know cats were such dangerous critters.
In terms of witchcraft?
Yes, I didn't know the whole witchcraft.
Yeah, you
know.
Can't have cats in Africa.
No, you told this wonderful story about a soccer game and a cat got in the field, which must have been a witch trying to hex one of the teams.
Yep.
And the African man goes out there and does what he should have done, and according to custom.
Yeah, according to his culture, yeah.
Yes, just kill the cat right there in front of everybody. But then the Western audience seeing this, a guy ends up getting brought up on animal cruelty charges. So I understand, that, and that's one of the powerfuls of the book, but you chose two dynamics of coping that could have gone either way, and I've seen people go different ways. So one of the ways of coping, some people give up. Like I'm reading Hillbilly Elegy right now, which is a book of a lot, where he talks very objectively about people deciding not to get into the hustle, and but some people decide to dig in and they become ridiculous in their creative work ethic, and in many ways that might have led to your professional career. But there's this wonderful moment that I'm going to have you read now on page 139, and I just want to set the scene for everybody, because you are constantly getting in trouble in school, and again, I can't wait till my mom reads this, because you are just like getting detention all the time, and you're not fitting into the groups. You have this beautiful moment on the playground where you literally everybody's separating in their different parts, but you don't know what to do. But then you use this creative drive of yours and hustle. And so at the very bottom of that page, 139, start with immediately and then lead to the end of the chapter, because this is, shows how you coped.
Okay.
Then immediately.
So this is my life stories. I guess this is really the school years. Then immediately after assembly, there would be a race to the tuck shop, our cafeteria. Because the queue to buy food was so long, every minute you spent in the queue was working against your break time. The sooner you got your food, the longer you had to eat, play a game of soccer, or hang out. Also, if you got there late, the best food was gone. Two things were true about me at that age. One, I was still the fastest kid in the school. And two, I had no pride. The second, we were dismissed from assembly. I would run like a bat out of hell to the tuck shop so I could be the first one there. And I was always the first in line. I became notorious for being that guy, so much so that people started coming up to me in line. Hey, Trevor, can you buy this for me? Which would piss off the kids behind me because it was basically cutting the line. So people started approaching me during assembly. They'd say, hey, I've got 10 Rand. If you buy my food for me, I'll give you 2. That's when I learned, time is money. I realized people would pay me to buy their food because I was willing to run for it. I started telling everyone at assembly, place your orders, give me a list of what you want, give me a percentage of what you're going to spend, and I'll buy your food for you. I was an overnight success. Fat guys were my number one customers. They loved food but couldn't run. I had all these rich, fat, white kids who were like, this is fantastic. My parents spoil me, I've got money, and now I've got a way I can get food without having to work for it. And I still get my break. I had so many customers, I was turning kids away. I had a rule. I would take 5 orders a day, high bidders only. I'd make so much that I could buy my lunch using other kids' money and keep the lunch money my mom gave me for pocket cash. Then I could afford to catch a bus home instead of walking or save up to buy whatever. Every day I'd take orders. Assembly would end and I'd make my mad dash and buy everybody's hot dogs and Cokes and muffins. If you paid me extra, you could even tell me where you'd be and I'd deliver it to you. I'd found my niche. Since I belonged to no group, I learned to move seamlessly between groups. I floated. I was a chameleon. Still, a cultural chameleon. I learned how to blend. I could play sports with the jocks. I could talk computers with the nerds. I could jump in the circle and dance with the township kids. I popped around to everyone, working, chatting, telling jokes, making deliveries. I was like a weed dealer, but of food. The weed guy is always welcome at the party. He's not part of the circle, but he's invited into the circle temporarily because of what he can offer. And that's who I was, always an outsider. As the outsider, you can retreat into a shell, be anonymous, be invisible. Or you can go the other way. You protect yourself by opening up. You don't ask to be accepted for everything you are, just the one part of yourself that you're willing to share. For me, it was humor. I learned that even though I didn't belong to one group, I could be a part of any group that was laughing. I'd drop in, pass out the snacks, tell a few jokes. I'd perform for them. I'd catch a bit of their conversation, learn more about their group, and then leave. I never overstayed my welcome. I wasn't popular, but I wasn't an outcast. I was everywhere with everybody, and at the same time, I was all by myself.
That's powerful. And so, in a sense, in this world that you were born into of a delusion of race, with people that you saw buy into that in tough ways, somehow, not only did it motivate in you a spirit of working really hard, and we'll get a little bit more into that, but But to me, it also gave me this powerful sense to identify with others, which I think is empathy, the ability to see and understand other groups. And I want to shift really quickly to just driving that empathy home, because there's this understanding that hurt people often hurt people.
Yes.
And they carry scars with them. But then there are folks like you who, you read this book, clearly you went through your toughness and got hurt, but something happened in you that it spawned a love. And this is a moment that to me was chilling. Chilling. This is a very scary moment for me when I read this passage. But what you saw in the midst of your tears and the crisis, what you saw is really powerful to me. And so let me just say this. We said that your own group, and I shouldn't say your group, but the people that look like you and me, the coloreds, mm-hmm. were some of the harshest to you.
Yes.
And you're a little boy, and you go, and I'm on page 124. You're a little boy, and you go to pick mulberries off of the mulberry tree. And you're excited about the fruit that you have. And you encounter a bunch of colored boys who, again, the harshest experience. And what I think is powerful about this passage, and I want you to go from the middle of that page, Abel wasn't laughing, all the way down to the end of, but I knew I'd done a terrible thing, which is on 125, but just about one full page of reading. But I want to just put this to the abuser in the house, who was your mom's stepdad.
He was living with us on and off at the time. And on this particular day, I had just been bullied by the kids. We were living in a colored area. And around that season, kids would pick mulberries off a mulberry tree, and I was picking them with them. And the kids just decided to, just turn on me and started bullying me and beating me with, hitting me with mulberries and cursing me out.
Yes.
And this is the story of when I came home and told my parents, well, my mom, and then, my stepdad,
right.
The story.
And just as a side about your mother, and I've had this childhood reaction, when you go home to your mother and you want her to be upset, but your mom laughed.
Yeah.
And she laughed because at first she thought you were covered with blood, and then she realized it was
mulberry juice.
Mulberry juice.
Yes.
So now she's not taking you seriously, but she says something really sweet. She goes, you're hurt on the inside, but you're not hurt on the outside, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
And then Abel comes home, this scary, big man, and why don't you take it from there, what happens?
So you want me to go from Abel was laughing to where?
Abel wasn't laughing to right here, I'd done a terrible thing.
Abel wasn't laughing. As I told him what the bullies had done, I could see the anger building up inside him. With Abel's anger, there was no ranting and raving, no clenched fists. He sat there on the couch listening to me, not saying a word. Then, very calm and deliberate, he stood up. Take me to these boys, he said. Yes, I thought, this is it. Big brother is going to get my revenge for me. We got into his car and drove up the road, stopping a few houses down from the tree. It was dark now, except for the light from the street lamps, but we could see the boys were still there playing under the tree. I pointed to the ringleader. That's the one. He was the main one. Abel slammed his foot on the gas and shot up onto the grass and straight toward the bottom of the tree. He jumped out. I jumped out. As soon as the kids saw me, they knew exactly what was happening. They scattered and ran like hell. Abel was quick. Good Lord, he was fast. The ringleader had made a dash for it and was trying to climb over a wall. Abel grabbed him, pulled him down, and dragged him back. Then he stripped a branch off the tree, a switch, and started whipping him. He whipped the shit out of him, and I loved it. I've never enjoyed anything as much as I enjoyed that moment. Revenge truly is sweet. It takes you to a dark place, but man, it satisfies a thirst. Then there was the strangest moment where it flipped. I caught a glimpse of the look of terror in the boy's face, and I realized that Abel had gone past getting revenge for me. He wasn't doing this to teach the kid a lesson. He was just beating him. He was a grown man, venting his rage on a 12-year-old boy. In an instant, I went from, yes, I got my revenge, to no, 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 too much, shit, 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 dear God, what have I done? Once this kid was beat to shit, Abel dragged him over to the car and held him up in front of me. Say you're sorry. The kid was whimpering, trembling. He looked me in the eye, and I'd never seen fear in someone's eyes like I saw in his. He'd been beaten by a stranger in a way I don't think he'd ever been beaten before. He said he was sorry. But it was like his apology wasn't for what he'd done to me. It was like he was sorry for every bad thing he'd ever done in his life, because he didn't know there could be a punishment like this. Looking in that boy's eyes, I realized how much he and I had in common. He was a kid. I was a kid. He was crying. I was crying. He was a colored boy in South Africa, taught how to hate and how to hate himself. Who had bullied him that he needed to bully me? He'd made me feel fear. And to get my revenge, I'd unleashed my own hell on his world. But I knew I'd done a terrible thing.
Yes. And so that moment of empathy to me, I read that and it was just so powerful, because it's a step that not everybody can get to, who go through pain. And these kids went from literally relentlessly beating you to moments later you seeing your common humanity, your oneness with them. And do you think, growing up, what you did, and I think about this in communities which I lived and work, that you see people who sometimes get so caught up, they become the very demon that they often experienced.
Most definitely. And I think that is probably the most difficult thing for us to combat in ourselves, is the need for revenge. You know, oftentimes people mistake justice and revenge. It is hard, and I mean, you look at America right now, to be in a place where people are asked to have empathy for those who seem to have voted against the majority's best interests. You know, how do you ask black people in America to empathize with their oppressors? And it is extremely difficult. Most of the time we are not capable of it. But I grew up in a country where it was necessary. And I learned it from my mom. And I think we were lucky to be in a country where we had Nelson Mandela, who exhibited that. You know, it was Barack Obama who had a very beautiful phrase, you know, just after Nelson Mandela's funeral, where he said, "Nelson Mandela taught me that you could free not only the prisoner, but also the guard." And that was a powerful moment that I realized I had understood early on in my life. And that was oftentimes the person that was hurting you or oppressing you themselves was oppressed and hurt, even though they didn't seem to be. And in your need for revenge, the cycle would never break. I would go after that person, they would come after me, they would come after me, go after them. I mean, it's the story of gang violence, both in America and in South Africa. It's the reason it never ends. Everything is revenge for what happened. There is no one who says it stops. And so because it doesn't stop, everybody dies. And this moment for me was one where I had to look into the eyes of the person who I was getting my revenge on. And maybe that was it. Maybe that was that moment where I saw a human being on the other side of my revenge, which oftentimes we don't. And I realized that I didn't want to be responsible for that. I didn't want to live in a world where I was making people feel like that. That wasn't me winning. That was us losing, but me giving them what they gave me, which means now you had two hurt people, as opposed to one hurt person who was trying to heal and another person who needed to be enlightened.
And I'm not sure if you consciously put this into your book, but your spirit is in this book. Even when you talk about police officers, I love how you joke about police officers in the book about how in America they go through the ruse. Why did you pull me over, officer? Well, you were going a little bit over the speed limit. Well, you know you pulled me over because I'm a black man.
Yes.
I'm running the wrong neighborhood. But you're like, in South Africa, they don't even bother with that.
Yeah, that's what I enjoy about South Africa. People often ask me, they go, what's the big differences you find between America and South Africa? There are a lot of mirror images between us as nations, you know, nations that have histories of colonization and, you know, histories of oppression and racial segregation. One of the biggest advantages I feel we have in South Africa is there isn't the facade. You know, nobody denies it. We know that the racism is there. We had to go through a Truth and Reconciliation Commission where we all had to acknowledge it. And even that was a beautiful thing that gave people a sense of justice, because no longer, you know, you couldn't live in a world where people made you feel like you were mad. You know, in America, still there's people going, oh, I mean, racism is gone. That's not a thing. You know, slavery even that bad. To have those conversations is ridiculous. And we still have that. We had that growing up. You know, the police didn't lie to us. I've constantly been shocked when I've been pulled over in the U.S. where policemen, like, just ask me questions. I remember I got pulled over once. I was driving outside. I was up New York, upstate. And I got pulled over, and the policeman said, he said, sir, do you know why I pulled you over? And I turned to him, and I didn't even realize, because we have a very different relationship with our police. And I said, no. I said, I'm not in your mind. How would I know that? He said, no. What do you mean, do I know why you pulled me over? No, I don't. You know, and you could see he had never heard that response. But I had never heard a person say that. Why would I know why you pulled me over? That but the facade of everything, like him trying to act like there was some other reason for him. And then my friend said to me, hey, man, if you're a black guy driving a nice car, you're going to get pulled over. This is how it works, and this is the world that we live in. Back home, the policeman would just tell you. The guy would pull you over, and then he would just go, hey, what are you blackies doing here? You know? And we'd be like, oh, just driving around, officer. And he'd be like, you got any drugs? And be like, no. Got any guns? No. And be like, all right, get out of here, go. But it was just like, it sounds strange, but it's easier to heal when there is brutal honesty than when people act like it's not there.
And so you write in a way that you expose this stuff, but you also show even an empathy for the police officer. At one point, you're like, they have a job as well. You know, they're caught in this thing. But I wanted this last reading I want you to do, because there's one figure in your book that even I, when I saw you in the back, it's just hard for me in this country of America, and seeing this through your eyes in South Africa, knowing that we live in a nation with a culture that makes rape more prevalent, a culture of sexual abuse and physical violence against women that is at levels that most Americans don't want to face and don't want to see. And so on page 254, I want you to just, and this will be the last one, then we'll get to some questions. But this was very important for me, because you point out the utter hypocrisy, the trap of sexual violence, of domestic violence, of assault. And you as a child experiencing this. So can you just start here at late one night?
Okay.
The house filled up with smoke. And this is basically...
Where do you want me to go to?
Oh, I'm sorry. And then go right over to... then go right to the bottom. End at the bottom of this page here, of 256.
Come back in the morning.
Yes.
All right.
And then, but the one thing I want to, just as a backstory to set the story up, Abel, your stepfather, starts drinking heavily.
Yeah.
Gives up marijuana, goes to alcohol, starts drinking heavily, and he would come home, and you gave some almost comical situations where he would kick you out of your bed because he was insisting that was his bed, or he'd be urinating in a corner thinking it was a toilet. All of these things, but now he comes in, and unfortunately, very bad things happen. But why don't you start with late one night?
All right. Late one night, we woke up to a house filled with smoke. Abel hadn't come home by the time we'd gone to bed, and I'd fallen asleep in my mother's room with her and Andrew, who was still a baby. I jerked awake to her shaking me and screaming, "Trevor! Trevor!" There was smoke everywhere. We thought the house was burning down. My mom ran down the hallway to the kitchen, where she discovered the kitchen on fire. Abel had driven home drunk, blind drunk, drunker than we'd ever seen him before. He'd been hungry, tried to heat up some food on the stove, and passed out on the couch while it was cooking. The pot had burned itself out and burned up the kitchen wall behind the stove. The smoke was billowing everywhere. She turned off the stove and opened the doors and the windows to try air the place out. Then she went over to the couch and woke him up and started berating him for nearly burning the house down. He was too drunk to care. She came back into the bedroom, picked up the phone, and called my grandmother. She started going on and on about Abel and his drinking. This man, he's going to kill us one day. He almost burnt the house down. Abel walked into the bedroom, very calm, very quiet. His eyes were blood red, his eyelids heavy. He put his finger on the cradle and hung up the call. My mom lost it. How dare you? Don't you hang up my phone call. Who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing? You don't tell people what's happening in this house, he said. Oh, please. You worried about what the world is thinking. Worry about this world. Worry about what your family is thinking. Abel towered over my mother. He didn't raise his voice, didn't get angry. Mbui, he said softly, you don't respect me. Respect? You almost burned down our house. Respect? Oh, please, earn your respect. You want me to respect you as a man, then act like a man. Drinking your money in the streets, and where are your child's diapers? Respect, earn your respect. Mbui, you're not a man, you're a child. Mbui, I can't have a child for a husband. Mbui, I've got my own children to raise. Mbui, shut up. A man who comes home drunk, Mbui, shut up, and burns down the house, Mbui, and call yourself a father. And then out of nowhere, like a clap of thunder when there was no clouds, crack, he smacked her across the face. She ricocheted off the wall and collapsed like a ton of bricks. I'd never seen anything like it. She went down and stayed down for a good 30 seconds. Andrew, my baby brother, started screaming. I don't remember going to pick him up, but I clearly remember holding him at some point. My mom pulled herself up and struggled back to her feet and launched right back into him. She'd clearly been knocked for a loop, but she was trying to act more with it than she was. I could see the disbelief in her face. This had never happened to her before in her life. She got right back in his face and started shouting at him, did you just hit me? The whole time in my head, I kept thinking the same thing. The same thing Abel was saying. Shut up, Mom. Shut up. You're going to make it worse. Because I knew, as the receiver of many beatings, the one thing that didn't help is talking back. But she wouldn't stay quiet. Did you just hit me? Mbui, I told you. No man has ever. Don't you think you can control me when you can't even control your crack? He hit her again. She stumbled back, but this time didn't fall. She scrambled, grabbed me and grabbed Andrew. Let's go. We're leaving. We ran out of the house and up the road. It was the dead of night, cold outside. I was wearing nothing but a t-shirt and sweatpants. We walked to the Eden Park police station over a kilometer away. My mom marched us in, and there were two cops on duty at the front desk. I'm here to lay a charge, she said. What are you here to lay a charge about? I'm here to lay a charge against the man who hit me. To this day, I'll never forget the patronizing, condescending way they spoke to her. Calm down, lady, calm down. Who hit you? My husband. Your husband? What did you do? Did you make him angry? Did I? What? No, he hit me. I'm here to lay a charge against. No, no, ma'am. Why do you want to make a case, eh? You sure you want to do this? Go home and talk to your husband. You do know once you lay charges, you can't take them back. He'll have a criminal record. His life will never be the same. Do you really want your husband going to jail? My mom kept insisting that they take a statement and open a case, and they actually refused. They refused to write up a charge sheet. This is a family thing, they said. You don't want to involve the police. Maybe you want to think it over and come back in the morning.
And that has a terrible consequence. The beatings continue. They're not, as you say in the book, a year might go past and then it happens. 2 years might go past, it happens again. You eventually get out of the house, but the end. And I don't want to in any way talk about the end, but except to say that it comes back in terrible consequence. That the police just do nothing. It's just sort of wash it away.
That's, you know, a story that's all too familiar. It's funny. I was watching the OJ documentary Made in America. And I was shocked at the parallels even in that story. You know, how many times police got called to OJ's house, Nicole Simpson calling 911. And the thing that people forget is that police are still men. Police are still people. And unfortunately, they are subject to the same ills as their society. And one of those ills is a lack of urgency when it comes to protecting women and children. Women and children who are facing domestic abuse. And I couldn't believe it, because as a kid, that was one of the first moments I remember losing faith in the police. I had grown up enamored by police. I wanted to be a policeman as a kid. You know, what they did seemed so noble. They were the protectors. Although the people who made sure that good continued. And here I was standing with my mom, who I had never seen in a weak position. And here she was, helpless, for the first time. And those people who were supposed to protect and serve us turned her away because she was causing a fuss. And that never left me, you know. And the stories, unfortunately, got worse in our lives. And it was a story that was all too familiar. My aunt was abused by her husband. My grandmother was hit by her husband, you know. And that became one of the most frightening realizations for me, is because I would hear so many people tell stories where they would go, you should leave him, you know. Oh, you always hear people saying to women, why don't you leave him? You know, why don't you go? And I remember thinking one day when listening to my mom and my grand and my aunt talk, I was like, where do you go? Where do you go when your world is a world of abuse? You know, where do you go? Do you now go into the space of being a single mother with multiple kids, and now you are seen as a whore? The woman who has no husband with these multiple children, where do you go? And that was honestly one of the you know, it stuck with me forever. And I mean, it's the reason till this day I involve myself in as many programs as I can to try and raise awareness and fight against domestic abuse. But until it is seen as something that needs to be fought from the top down, we will always live in societies where, like in America, every 30 seconds there is a woman who is subject to domestic abuse. And it's a cycle that won't change unless we do something about it. And funny enough, it's something that men need to do something about. Men with other men, sitting men down with each other and going, hey man, that doesn't make you stronger. That doesn't make you a man. That doesn't make you any more powerful in my eyes. In fact, I see you as being weak, you know. And that was just the beginning, unfortunately, for the journey that we were about to go on.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. I want to ask my last question, get to the books, but I want to read this part right now, because there's one section of the book that I felt this very kinship with, and it was with Alex, because you were describing a neighborhood, and this was like, I felt like this was like an American city. I felt a lot of kinship with parts of my city. You go through this long period of your life, your teenage years, you're moving out with your mom, you're intending to go to college, but you get caught up in the hustle and the city. And I love this, and for those who will, I feel like I'm in church. Please open your Bibles page. but it's at the bottom of 219. He said, the hood has a gravitational pull. It never leaves you behind, but it also never lets you leave. Because by making the choice to leave, you're insulting the place that raised you and made you and never turned you away. And that place fights you back. As soon as things are going well for you in the hood, it's time to go. Because the hood will drag you back in. It will find a way. There will be a guy who steals the thing and puts it in your car, and the cops find it. It's something. You can't stay. You think you can. You'll start doing better, and you'll bring your hood friends out to a nice nightclub, and the next thing you know, somebody starts a fight, and one of your friends pulls a gun, and somebody's getting shot, and you're left standing around going, what just happened? The hood just happened.
It's exactly what it is. It's a cycle that's unfortunate. And you know, there is always the constant dilemma. I mean, my mom and I used to fight about it all the time. I would say to my mom, you know, why leave the hood? We're supposed to stay in the hood and work to get things better. And my mom would say, but you as a young man, the hood won't let you leave. You know, as soon as you start progressing, the hood's going to suck you back in. It'll find a way. And it'll find a way to get you wrapped up in something that you shouldn't be wrapped up in. And that was really why my mom pushed me, you know, to do everything I could in life. We couldn't afford college. We really came from, you know, the humblest of beginnings. But she always fought me to search for more. And like, she said I should go hang out with my cousin at his university. And I said, but that's the same. If I'm in the hood and I'm at my cousin's university, it's the same. I'm just hanging out. And she said, no, but now you're hanging out with people who will push you to become more than you are. You will see them progressing. You will see them, you know, trying to become better. And I know you as a person. You won't allow yourself to get left behind.
And I appreciated that, because people can play by the rules, try everything like that. There's something about environments like that that could trip you up, could frustrate you. And
it is difficult, but what my mom made me realize was, because she's done that, is that you almost have to get out and leave and get to a point where you've established yourself and your world enough to the point where you can come back and give back. But if you, you know, you need that incubator period almost, where you are insulated from the ills of the hood, so that when you are strong enough, you can come back and make a positive impact. And that's what my mom did. You know, she went back into a community. She's still there now, and she's given people jobs, and she's got her own, you know, she's got her own business that she runs, and she employs people in her community where she grew up, and she found a way to go back. But she always says to me, if I never left that place, it would have never left me, and I wouldn't be able to bring the world into the hood.
Right.
And that was it. And that really is the overlying theme of the book. I wrote a lot of stories from my life. I tried to coalesce as many ideas as I could. And in the end, I came to realize that I'm not the hero of my story. You know, when I wrote this book, I thought I was. I think we all think we are. But I came to realize that my mom was the hero of my story.
Clearly.
You know, I was just her punk-ass sidekick. and she truly was and continues to be a miraculous person. She's strong, she's beautiful, she's powerful. You know, she had to raise a man and still be a woman and still be the head of the household and still be more. And writing the book, honestly, when I wrote it, I thought I was just telling stories. When I looked at all of them and I started putting the pieces of the puzzle together, I came to realize that in essence it became a love letter to my mom. And I don't think I fully appreciated her growing up. I'm lucky in that we were very close, and I really did. You know, I wasn't one of those kids where I didn't care for my... I loved my mom, and she loved me, and the affection was never one that we hid. We were really, really close. But I don't think... even until I wrote the book, I was like... It went from a, wow, she's good, to like, I can't even believe I was lucky enough to share a life with this human being. And really, that's what this book has become for me.
That's incredible.
And I'm glad I got to appreciate that while she's still around.
Well, I'm glad that you shared it with us. But now I've got a bunch of questions here from folks who want to take us off book into other things. And so you know that the Trump questions are going to come. So here is one. I wish people put their names so I could embarrass them. But this is our first Trump question for the night, sir.
Yes.
You once compared Trump to several African dictators.
Yes.
One was not enough. Several, I guess.
Yes.
Okay. Perhaps you can share some insights into how this thing will play out over the next 4 years.
You know, that's a difficult question to answer because, as I was saying to Senator Booker earlier...
Corey.
You know what's funny is you are modest, and you, when I call you Senator Booker, he always says Corey to everyone. And I go, Senator Booker, and he goes, Corey. And he's modest because he's going like, I don't want the importance. What you don't realize is I want the importance of having a friend who's a senator. That's why I'm saying it. So we were chatting earlier about this, and I do recognize Donald Trump as a leader that we have experienced all too often in Africa and in many third world countries. A leader who comes along, you know, who has a populist message, who claims to have the solution to everything, and seems to be, you know, undefeatable, seems to, you know, operate beyond reproach. And yet, the one thing that throws me is, I understand Donald Trump has a narcissistic appearance and he, you know, he loves praise, and that's really what he looks for. But the big difference is in our country, like with our leader, he is driven by money, you know. And I know that Donald Trump is also driven by money, but I almost hope that that's the only thing. Because if there's something more than that, then you're in trouble. Then we're all in trouble. Because when it's money, you just have to look out for the corruption. There will be someone who is pilfering the treasury and finding ways to make money from flying his private jet and make the Secret Service pay for it and so on. But those are small things in comparison to someone who's trying to shape a country in their image or an image that they perceive themselves to be. And that's where you go into the deeper, darker leaders of not just Africa but in South America. And that's where we look to, you know, our leaders who are there to help guide us, because I always hear everyone saying, I heard it from the beginning, people said, can't happen in America, man, can't happen. And I mean, that was my first week in America on The Daily Show when I said Donald Trump. I saw him and immediately I was like, oh man, this guy's going to do well. And people around me were like, no, that's American politics. We have the crazies in the summertime and then we get rid of them. This is American politics. And I said, no. I was like, that guy's going to do well. I can see it in him. I've seen this before. And people didn't understand. And that's why I made that comparison, because all of those men had exactly the same storyline. And all of those men did things that had never been done before. And that's why we have to be even more vigilant, because it is the inches that people give up that lead to the miles that are lost. You know, it's a scary place to be in, but that's why I say, you know, I'm honestly honored to at least know you, and I look to people like you for guidance, because we'll need to be together and move forward and fight as much as we can. I will say this on the bright side, and this has happened in South Africa. It goes to the movie analogy. Sometimes the world needs aliens to invade for us to realize that we've been fighting against each other for the wrong reasons. And if you look at what's happened now, just look at since Donald Trump has you know, since he won the election, people are standing up, fighting and donating to Planned Parenthood. People are standing up and supporting the Anti-Defamation League. People are marching together. Women are united and more powerful than ever before. You know, I've seen women, even in my office, who've gone, we are mobilizing now. We are, like, Hillary's mark is one that cannot be denied. The fire has been lit, you know? And you look now, who would have thought? I mean, you see it all over social media. You see it, you know, it was even one of the rabbis who came out and said, if Muslims are going to get registered, we are registering yes. as Muslims.
Yes.
We stand with you because we know what it's like to be registered. We know how this can go. We've seen this world before. We won't even give it an inch to see if we're wrong. And I thought to myself, can you imagine Americans, a post 9/11 America, where Americans are going, we stand with you. Muslims, we stand with you. And strangely enough, it's like those are the things that Donald Trump may come to create without even realizing it, is bringing America together against him.
All right, so enough of that. let's bring this down to the question that I get annoyed about because I'm asked it all the time. So, and you know, I know I'm in a holy place, and you should do unto others as you want them to do unto you. But if I'm ever on your show, don't do this to me. There's a couple people here. One would like to know, are you single? The other wants to know, would you kindly go out on a date with me? Another person wants to know your phone number. So
I'm definitely doing this to you on my show. Just so you know. No, I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky that I'm not single right now. I'm in a great relationship, and I'm really lucky. A very beautiful woman, a beautiful person as well, which is really something that I value. So yes, I'm in a great place.
All right.
But thank you for asking. Thank you very much for asking.
Baruch Hashem. Okay. there's a lot of people that want sort of advice to you about what to do during this horrible period. Like, what advice would you give to any college students deeply affected by the election cycle who want to move beyond their feelings and reach out to find, be the solution for our ailing society?
Well, I too had that question, and there was a very wise man who said to me, don't let this be a situation where you become paralyzed by the feeling that you can do nothing. There are many things you can do. There are many stands that you can take. Look for situations where you can become part of the change you want to see. So look to organizations that need your help. Look to small things that you can make. We always look at the, you know, the biggest change that needs to be made, and we realize it's impossible, and so instead we do nothing. And a lot of the time it's like working out. It's impossible to change your body overnight, but you can start by just walking a little bit every day. And it's small things like mentoring a young child in your community, going out into urban areas, going out into communities where there's poverty, and just helping one person. If everyone is helping one person, if everyone is raising money, if everyone's donating like Bernie Sanders style to anti-defamation leagues and Planned Parenthood and organizations that need us, we're all doing a little, and that is how you create a lot. And when I heard that really, really inspired me. And the person I heard that from is a friend of mine named Corey. So thank you very much for that. But that's what I believe in, but thank you.
All right. But how do you channel the emotion? Like you, I'm sure you've seen the kind of anger and energy and one question was, which I can't find right now, but they basically said, you know, how do you continue to make jokes during a time when you're dealing with all this bad news?
Oh, because you must never let them take it away from you. That's why. You must never, ever let them take it away from you. That is something my mother taught me 1,000 times over. She said, oh, honey, I can laugh. I can always laugh. I laugh until I cry. You can't stop me from laughing. You know, that was one of the most beautiful things that I've learned over and over through time, and that is you have the ability to laugh. You it doesn't mean the pain is not real. It doesn't mean what's happening is not there. You're not minimizing what you are going through. But laughter, for me, is the anesthesia of the mind. It just for a moment helps you focus on what you're trying to do, and it reminds you of a feeling. You know, when you laugh, there's a reason the chemicals inside your body change. It's almost like for that moment, you are transported to a place where nothing is wrong. You're transported to a place where everything is going well.
But it's more that you do more than that, man. And as I tried to say to him behind, back when we were backstage, that, you know, he reminds me of a tradition of Richard Pryor and Red Fox and a lot of these early comedians that my father and mother listened to. I would sneak to the balcony and listen to their Richard Pryor tape. But he took horrible racial realities and twisted them in a way that they were humorous, and the laughter was catharsis. It was healing. And I tell you, when I watch your show at times, feeling just down about some ridiculous thing, so I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to do with appointments like Jeff Sessions and others that hurt. I mean, I was very, very angry yesterday.
I can imagine.
But I imagine that when you go on, you are able to take people that are hurting and heal and also expose. Your show exposes so much, and it makes us laugh, but it's really exposing hypocrisy and incongruencies.
Well, if you think about it, that's the essence of what comedy is supposed to do. That is what Richard Pryor was doing, essentially. That is the heart of what comedy does. A lot of people don't realize that that's what makes great comedy, is it exposes the truth. It was Dick Gregory who said to me, an amazing man who did comedy at a time when it was extremely difficult in America. He faced, the utmost hardships. He said to me, pulled me aside here in Washington, D.C., and he said to me, he said, young man, he said, one piece of advice I can give you. He said, don't try to make jokes. Forget the jokes. He said, look for the truth. He said, the truth is funnier than anything you could try and imagine. And that was true, and that is what I'm trying to do. That is what we should all be trying to do, is you expose them. That is what my mom was saying to me, you know, with domestic abuse. I always used to say to my mom, because I was like, why do you tell people that you were abused? Why don't you just keep quiet? And then she goes, why? She said, why, honey? Why must I be ashamed because some man couldn't control himself? Why must I be ashamed because he was a person who was an alcoholic? She said, oh, no, I'm not ashamed. I'm a survivor, and I'm here. So she would go, I'm going to expose you. I'm going to shine that light on you because you don't want to be in the light. I'm proud. She'd always say to you, she'd go, I thrive in the light, honey. You are the one who's hiding in the shadows if you are that person. And that is what comedy is doing. That is what we're trying to do with the show, is you keep shining the light on them. And though many of them may be shameless, that light, you keep shining it on them. Like last night, what happened at Hamilton, I can tell you now, they can try brush it off as much as they want, but that shames them. That thing is powerful. That light that shines on them makes them feel And they know they feel it. And it's a powerful thing to use. And we just have to keep on using it. We just have to keep on using it. Because oftentimes, that's all you have. That's really one of the biggest things that helped the apartheid movement. Yes, there were protests. Yes, there were people mobilizing against the government. But one of the biggest things that ended apartheid in South Africa? Shame. It was the shame. It was a country that couldn't stand to look other leaders in the world. It was a president who could no longer show his face on an international stage. It was shame. And shame is a powerful, powerful tool that we have when used correctly, when used to expose hypocrisy and bigotry and misogyny. Shame is the most powerful tool we possess. And through comedy, you can use that all the time.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so this is a person that's asking for some advice for American black folks and wants to know, what do you think that the next generation coming behind you, is that Generation Z? Or because you're what year were you born?
84.
Oh, so you are a millennial.
I'm a millennial.
You are officially a millennial. The numbers, it's just it's a bullying generation because they're bigger than us X-geners. More of them than you, yes. More of you than me.
And a beautiful generation. You know, that's one of the things I look to. I always try and find the silver lining. Have you looked at the map? You know, the voting map. Have you looked at it?
A millennial
when it's divided
map. Yes.
By age.
Yes.
Just look at the millennial map. The whole thing was blue. And now, what made me happy about that wasn't because it was Democrat per se. No. It was an entire generation that identified Trump and his promises and his rhetoric as something that they and America didn't stand for.
Right.
And that is a beautiful image. It's like, don't forget that that is the future. Don't forget that that's still there.
But I want to... First of all, I want to affirm what you said. The data on millennial Republicans, they believe in the science of climate change. They believe in LGBT rights.
Yeah.
I mean, they're far, far more progressive.
It's age.
Amazing to me. And that's the power of... You say that, but... one of my favorite speeches by President Obama this year, and he's given a lot of amazing speeches. I'm going to miss having him and Michelle in the White House.
We all will.
But he spoke at Howard University to African Americans, and he's like, look, this isn't complicated. Y'all need to vote. But millennials vote at about 40, your generation votes about 46%. Notice how I said that. Not my generation, your generation. Was it like 46% in presidential elections, which is still below.
Yes.
And then for midterm elections, when Congress is up in the 20th percentiles, and now this is the biggest generation. He was like, this isn't complicated, just vote. You don't need to occupy anything, just vote. And because if millennials voted at the same rate as the generations ahead of them, they would transform the federal government.
Yes.
In an election. So this person's asking, though, not just about the generation as a whole. This one wants to know about for the young blacks growing up behind you, coming up younger than you, do you have specific advice for African-American youth?
One of the biggest, two things I would say. One is get involved. Get involved on all levels. Get involved at all levels. Be talking, be educating yourself, be reading up, because that is the tool. That is literally how the leaders in South Africa worked the liberation movement. It was just reading. It was through an exchange of thoughts and ideas. And if young black Americans can continue to enrich themselves with information, that information genuinely is. It's. I always say to people, like, oh, it's such a simple solution, and yet so many people don't choose to use it. And that is, knowledge is power. It genuinely is. And to those youngsters, I go, you have tools at your disposal that nobody had before. You can get a book at the, you know, a click of a button, just press your screen, and there's the information that you seek. You don't even have to buy it anymore. There's Wikipedia, there's everything that's out there telling you what you need to know. So to those people, I just say, get involved, read, educate yourself, learn what you can do to overcome these odds and to become better than the system that has been designed to oppress you. But one of the most important things, and that's what my mom taught me, and it's so hard to do, it is genuinely hard to do, and I know some people don't agree with me. Be careful that you are not governed by your anger. Be careful that your anger doesn't turn to hate, because if you are not careful, you will be in a place where you are blinded by that. If you are not careful, you will be in a space where you are not trying to fix, you are trying to get revenge. You are trying to beat that child that beat you, and you're going to grow up and you're in a world that is against you. You're in a world that has been set up, but it won't be like that forever. But you know, one of the best examples I give is I used to box in South Africa, not professionally, but I had a friend of mine who was a world champion, and we used to box together. And he used to punch me in the face. And I used to get so angry, and I would lose it, and I would come flailing at him. And then one day he stopped me, and he said, why are you angry? And I said, because you punched me in the face. And he said, that's what we're doing here. And he said, when you step into this ring, surely you know that you're going to get punched in the face. And I said, I don't like it. He said, no one likes getting punched in the face. He said, but what you've got to do is you've got to acknowledge where you are. And once you go, okay, I'm in a world where I'm going to get punched in the face. What are the things I can do to mitigate that? You go, practice blocking, think about how I can jab back, and most importantly, temper it. Because when you're angry, you don't see through the rage. You no longer think of how to get back. And if you lose that, you lose every advantage you have. And that is the one thing. And, the most important thing for black youth, and I will say this, just, man, keep creating. Your creativity and your magic is something that nobody can extinguish, you know? Like, I tell people all the time, I go, black Twitter is the only reason Twitter exists. Like, keep creating. Because you don't even realize, but you are, you know, like young black culture is permeating the world in a way that many people don't even realize. And some people only see the cultural appropriation aspect of it. I sometimes see it as a sneaky form of colonization, you know? I think of it the same way America. Do you know how America really conquered the world? It wasn't with army tanks and missiles. It was with TV shows and music. That's how America conquered the world. I remember McDonald's coming up in my neighborhood, and that was a thing that I aspired to. I remember watching Family Matters and going, I want to live like those people. I remember those images and ideas made me want to be like that. And that is a tool that's more powerful than any gun. And young black people have that ability. I was at a hockey game, and I'll never forget this moment. I'm sitting in the middle of a hockey game, only white people, Madison Square Garden, and genuinely looked around. There were no black people anywhere. Like, not even, I was fascinated. I was like, this is insane. And it was a great crowd, and everyone was having a good time. And then during one of the timeouts, music came on. And it was like one of the most hardcore hip-hop songs. And you just had all these white people just nodding their heads. No, but I mean, I was like, you don't even realize it, but 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people would have stood up and gone, what the hell is that thing? And yet now, it was just like, this is music. And you can seep in through your creativity, through your magic. You can seep in advice. And take over a world that no one thought you could. So advice. Just keep creating, man. Just keep exploring and sharing yourself, that blackness. Be proud of it. It's magic.
All right. Speed round, then we're done. Speed round questions.
Speed round.
Speed round. If you could have anybody on your show that you haven't had on your show, one dead person, one live person, who would they be?
One dead person, one alive person. Okay, dead person, I would want it to be Adolf Hitler. So then I would sit with him and go, with what's happening now, do you see similarities in yourself with this guy? I'd be like, no, tell me, what do you see here? And what could have stopped you? What could people have done to stop you earlier? And by the way, that mustache is weird. and one alive person, before he leaves office, I hope, President Barack Obama.
Wow.
Because, I'll tell you, I know it's a speed round.
Speed round, come on.
I know it's a speed round, but I will say this, because I think it's simpatico when you think about it. Someone said to me, they said, Trevor, did you think you'd be coming to America, to The Daily Show, and now you're going to be, Donald Trump is the president that you have to deal with? Did you ever imagine that? It's insane. And I said, I think it's actually perfect when you think about it, because when a half-black, half-African man was in the White House, Donald Trump spent years lambasting and insulting him. And it's only fitting that when Donald Trump is in the White House, a half-black, half-white African man spends the rest of the time doing that to him.
That is awesome. Okay, second and the last speed round questions. Who is a comedian you truly, truly respect and admire today, or one that when you were growing up was your hero?
Oh, who do I truly admire and respect? There are too many. There are too many for me to name one person. But, you know, Richard Pryor was really one comedian who, through his honesty, I think, connected with me on so many levels. I even tell people I'm even afraid to watch Richard Pryor. I think I watched one of his specials, and then I said no more because I was like, he'd be too much of an influence. Of course, I'd want to be exactly like him. But there have been many, and many have been influenced by him, and I look to them and their honesty. You know, it's everyone. It's Dave Chappelle. It's Chris Rock. It's Louis C.K. It's Eddie Izzard, you know, a comedian who did something from a different realm, who came in, I mean, a cross-dressing comedian. And what he did in the U.K. because of that was so powerful. But really, those are comedians who I look up to. And then I guess not a stand-up, but I'm a huge fan of Melissa McCarthy. I just think she's the funniest person in the world. So yeah, those are the people that I look up to. I go like, you guys are just, you're pioneers, you're amazing in what you're doing, and I admire you for everything.
Elected official today that really we shouldn't, the elected official shouldn't be in politics, but would make a great comedian.
Elected official today?
That would make a great comedian.
Great comedian? I think, look, President Obama would be amazing, but one, if I had one position to give, I would offer it to Donald Trump. I would go, look, man, you are a comedian. You're very, very funny. You've proved your point. Just leave it. It's not too late. Just leave it. Because I still say, you have a chance to be America's hero. Imagine if Donald Trump looked at America and said, hey, I've noticed, if he just came out and said, folks, I've noticed how divided I've made this nation seem. I've noticed how much pain I've brought, and so I decide to step down. It would be like, you are the greatest. He would have made America great, and I would offer him anything in the world of comedy.
Two last questions. If you could have somebody read your book that you know is not going to read your book.
If I could have somebody read it who I know is not going to read it. Again, President Barack Obama, honestly. No, because I our stories have so many parallels.
Very,
and I
very
don't know
much
if he'll have the time, but I hope he will.
Yeah, I honestly, there was a lot of things from Dreams of My Father that resonates so deeply with this book. And so that's my last question then. Understanding that you do have so much resonance with our president, will you or will you not run for president in 2020?
Well, I would run for president, but I have a birth certificate issue. So the answer is no. The answer is no.
Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Book Store and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.